Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, let's do this one more time. The economy is not the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy. It's not especially industrial anymore either. We'll do Syria and the global economy, and what to do when Hollywood says no. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 10th of September. White House speechwriters have been earning their paychecks, drafting the president's speech on Syria while keeping an eye on the ever-changing geopolitics of the thing. The markets are watching as well, oil traders in particular. Crude prices were down again today amid signs that a strike may not be in the offing after all, down about 2% all told. Oil, and you may have noticed, pump prices had been rising right along with the likelihood of American military action, which is interesting because Syria produces just about a thimble full of oil these days, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Okay, a thimble full in this case, that means less than a 10th% of the world's total oil production. Hardly worth mentioning. So why do traders flip out when the U.S. saber-rattles a two-bit oil producer like Syria?
I think the markets freak out because they think the sabers are going to be extended beyond Syria into some bordering countries.
Tom Kloza tracks global oil prices from his office in New Jersey. He says the markets factor in a worry premium of sorts, worry that a U.S. strike could spark a wider war in the Mideast and eventually disrupt oil supplies. Economist James Hamilton.
And I think, yes, it is quite rational to say there's at least a possibility.
Rational oil markets. Now, there's a concept, one that analyst Stephen Shork, for one, doesn't believe in.
It's just driven by fear and greed on the slight chance that dropping a couple of cruise missiles on Damascus will lead to some sort of broader regional conflict. It's a very limited proposition. Yet, we can never underestimate the stupidity of Wall Street money piling into this market.
Or, if you wanted to be a bit kinder, you could just view oil traders as the victims of international political gamesmanship. And given that there's not a whole lot of extra oil swishing around the Middle East these days, recent violence in Iraq and Libya took care of that, the guys bidding oil prices up every time Obama or Putin acts tough may not be so stupid after all. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Speaking of bidding prices up, or at least ginning up some enthusiasm, Apple had one of its big unveils today. It's a new iPhone, or should I say iPhones, because there were two of them at two different sticker prices. Ina Fried is a senior editor at All Things D. She was in Cupertino today for the announcement. Ina, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Usual pandemonium, I imagine, at an Apple event.
Yeah, you know, this is a little smaller because it was on Apple's campus, but throngs of reporters, satellite trucks, the usual shebang here for a new iPhone.
All right, well, about this new iPhone. First of all, the plastic one, the iPhone 5C. What does that C stand for anyway?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, they didn't specifically say, but I think it stands for color, since it comes in a bunch of shades, and China, because that's clearly one of the most important markets for Apple.
What, you're not loving cheap at all, the iPhone 5 cheap?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I thought about using that, but it's actually not that inexpensive. And the fact of the matter is they're still offering a cheaper iPhone. The iPhone 4S will sell for less than this 5C.
Why am I going to buy, then, the expensive top-of-the-line 5S and not the 5 cheap?
So they're touting basically three things. So a better camera and a faster processor, which are the kind of improvements we get in phones every year. And the other thing is this fingerprint reader that's on the home screen. Apple bought a company a year ago called Authentic that specializes in sort of state-of-the-art fingerprint readers, and the home button has one of these built in.
And so you can what? Unlock your phone and what else with your fingerprints?
Yeah, that was the interesting thing, is you can actually only use it to do two things. Log into your phone, which is obviously more secure than a passcode, and then also when you need to verify yourself to make iTunes purchases. So what's interesting is they're not making this available to developers to put into their own apps as a means of security.
I actually saw a tweet today, just to mix news stories, that said, oh, now the NSA is going to have my fingerprints too.
Exactly. And Apple did make a point of saying that it's not storing your fingerprint on its servers, and they are being very cautious. They're not making your fingerprint available to third-party applications, probably, you know, to err on the side of security and caution. So I think what they're doing for now is limiting perhaps the usefulness of the sensor, but making sure that people feel comfortable using it.
Talk to me for a second about Siri, would you? There's now a guy?
So yeah, Siri, you have the option of a male-sounding voice and a female-sounding voice. I don't know how Siri personally feels about that, but yeah, you can choose your preference.
Have we now reached the end of innovation with phones? I mean, if we're working on, you know, 41 megapixel cameras and gee whiz new colors, haven't we kind of jumped the shark?
Well, I think we've certainly hit a bit of a wall in terms of you're seeing phones about as big as the hand can hold. Samsung has one that's like 6 inches. So I think we've hit some current physical limits, and we're starting to wonder what's next. And I think there certainly wasn't a what's next today.
Ina Fried, she's a senior editor at All Things D. We got her down in Cupertino, California at the Big Apple event today. Ina, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Traders were underwhelmed by the events out of Cupertino. Apple shares dropped a bit more than 2% today. The broader markets did pretty well, though, and we'll get to those in turn. But about the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the blue chips, as they're called, the Dow 30. Well, sometimes you're in the club and sometimes you're out. Later this month, Alcoa, Bank of America, and Hewlett-Packard will be out. Nike, Goldman Sachs, and Visa are going to be in to the world's most relevant stock index. Or so the people behind the Dow would have you believe. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
A lot of claims are made about the Dow. It considers itself a benchmark for the economy, listing the country's most prominent firms.
They are America.
That's Bill Chambers. He teaches finance at Boston University. But the Dow isn't perfect. In fact, Chambers comes up with a whole list of disclaimers, like you see at the end of those miracle drug ads.
No group of 30 companies is ever going to reflect what is happening in the country. They still are really quite underweighted.
Chambers says one of the biggest problems is the Dow values companies based on their stock price, not how big they are. And the Dow is old. Tim Griske is chief investment officer of Solaris Asset Management. He calls the Dow antiquated.
Well, it really was your grandmother's market index. It's not what institutional investors use today.
Then why pay attention to the Dow at all? Well, because it's old, it's a way to compare the past and present. Consumers follow the Dow closely. They use it as a benchmark, and consumers have a huge impact on the economy. Mark Hamrick is with Bankrate.com.
Yeah, all you need to do is see a 5-inch high newspaper headline that says Dow falls 500 points to ruin retail sales in a given weekend.
And that's something that professional investors would notice. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Professional investors had it pretty good today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The unemployment rate for young people in this country is 16.3%. That is better than double the overall rate, and it totally holds true for Kendrick Culkin and most of his friends. Kendrick is a 17-year-old from Hayward, California, up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and he works in his grandfather's backyard, fixing up old washers and dryers and getting a load of life lessons along the way. Youth Radio sent us his story.
What I want to do is I just want to pull it apart, clean all the lint out of it, and then we'll hook it up and run it.
That's my grandpa, Craig Calkins. We get free machines off Craigslist, bring them back here, give them new life, and list them as refurbished back on Craigslist. I sold my first machine for $125. But for grandpa, this work is about more than just money.
The real reason that I got into this business was to find out where all the missing socks went.
My grandpa's been his own boss for over 30 years, and he's always had a mind for work.
When I was younger, I started with having a newspaper route on my bike, throwing newspapers on people's porches. Then I used to go around to the neighbors and see if I could mow their lawns.
But for me, I can't find jobs as easy now these days.
I think that you've done one of the things that is helpful for all youth to consider, which is to go to uncles and aunts and say, hey, can I go to work in your office? And sometimes you have to start out with not getting paid for things.
I think that's the difference between your generation and my generation. I feel like my generation is like, I'm doing this work and I'm not getting paid. Screw this.
Yeah. Maybe that's something for this generation to get over, is entitlement. Just pull it up like you were just doing it.
I'm making $10 an hour while learning how to repair machines and speak to customers.
I like passing the information down to you. It's really fun. And I find that this is a great way to connect with you. Working together is awesome. Push to start.
Wow, that sounds good, Kenny. Nice.
The sound of success.
Kendrick's story was produced for us by Youth Radio's New Options Desk. Coming up, Hollywood can be a tough business, you know.
If you went to somebody and said, hey, we have a movie, you could make $1 million. They just don't care. They don't want to make $1 million. They want to make 40, 50, 60, 100, $200 million.
But first, let's do the numbers. The delay in Syria was welcome news on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial is up 127 points, 0.8%, landed at 15,191. The NASDAQ put on 22.6%, 3729. The S&P 500 tacked on 12.7%, closed at 1683. The Dow, as we told you, made news of its own today, announcing it's shaking up its list of 30 companies. After more than 50 years, Alcoa is going to lose its spot. Stock dropped 0.3%. Hewlett-Packard also set to depart, closed down 0.4% today. Bank of America will also go, but today was up 0.9%. The incoming stocks all rose. Goldman Sachs up 3.5%. Visa climbed 3.3%. Nike rang up more than 2% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee holds a hearing on the 2020 census. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for July. And you'll need days to tour this inventory. America's largest RV show gets underway in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Pick up some chocolate for your road trip. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We told you the other day about how con men are alive and well and working hard in this digital society we're all part of nowadays. Only cybersecurity types call con men social engineers, and they have played key roles in some of the big hacks of late. Marketplace's Queen of Kim took us through one step by step.
There's this saying among social engineers that it's way easier to trick someone into letting you into a computer system than trying to hack into it.
In any security system, the human element is always the weakest.
Jordan Harbinger's a social engineer only for the good guys.
Being a human hacker is by far the most interesting for me because our brains have so many loopholes and Easter eggs and all kinds of things that normally exist in technical systems.
So Harbinger's day job is as a dating coach teaching human dynamics, and that connected him with social engineers. Harbinger told me about an experiment he did recently. He set out to see if he could use social engineering to penetrate companies that did top secret work with the government. He used the same steps that a con man would, only online. First step, gathering information. To find the companies, he looked for people with security clearances. Harbinger says they're smart enough not to disclose info like that on Facebook and Twitter.
But they're all on LinkedIn because that's where all these guys hang out to look for new jobs, network.
Once on LinkedIn, Harbinger found a group for people with security clearances. He created a fake profile. He said he was an engineer, and the group's moderators let him in. Now he had the names of companies and employees.
I made a profile as a recruiter thinking, okay, if these people are looking for jobs, let's give them fake jobs.
He sent out about 100 LinkedIn messages with fake job opportunities. Harbinger said he kept his profile intentionally vague. He didn't name employers, he didn't link to a fake website, or set up a fake company email. And he didn't need it because LinkedIn helped him exploit a glitch in the human psyche. People assumed that because he was in the top secret group, he was one of them. And there was another factor.
isolation was really the key, because if somebody is looking to leave their current company, they can't talk to their supervisors, so you don't know who to ask, what can I talk about, what can I talk about?
It's the classic con game. If fewer people are involved, fewer people can poke holes in the con. But on LinkedIn, instead of suspicion, Harbinger got bits of information about classified projects from engineers trying to impress him. He says some of the men, and most of them were men, were cagey about naming their employer or where they lived, but they gave out personal emails. Harbinger ran that through a free forensic search engine and found out that they had profiles in Yelp and other social media sites.
I used that to find out what kind of things he liked to do, coffee shops where he did work. So if I was actually a hacker, I would know what wireless networks this guy is working on, because I would know what he looks like, and I would know that he works at this Starbucks on this corner, and I would just wait for him there, and then I could start snooping around on his network traffic. And so it was putting together little bits of innocuous information to put the puzzle together from that.
Having found his targets, Harbinger set up a cover. He went on Facebook and created a profile of a female college student. She's attractive, but Harbinger says he made sure to make her attainable. And she's about to graduate with an engineering degree. Using the profile, Harbinger approached his target, saying, "Hey, I got an offer from your company, but I'm trying to figure out if I want to work there. Do you like your project?"
Guys love to come to the rescue, so I played to that. Vulnerability, you know, damsel in distress. I'm looking for a job. I don't know what to do. Can you help me?
Again, the oldest trick in the book, right?
A lot of guys were like, "I'm not supposed to tell you this, but I'm working on this, and it is so cool, and it's got billions of dollars in funding."
Harbinger says he stopped short of pushing for classified information, but he found out about testing facilities, budgets, and timelines.
Right now you're going, "I don't know if I'd fall for that. This would never work on me."
He says a lot of employers have the same attitude. So while they'll put resources into cybersecurity software or other technical defenses, many companies still don't train their employees on the dark arts of social engineering. Harbinger says if you're that kind of company that still thinks your people are too smart, then you're the kind of company hackers are going to look for. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
We turn now to Miley Cyrus, whatever it was she may have been doing at the Video Music Awards a couple of weeks ago, and the December issue of Vogue magazine. Vogue has dropped Ms. Cyrus from the cover of said issue because it decided her performance was distasteful. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports that even in the digital era, a cover photo is still worth a whole lot more than 1,000 words.
It's our party, we can do what we want. It's our party, we can say what we want.
The VMAs might have been Miley Cyrus's party, but Vogue magazine is editor Anna Wintour's.
You have no style or sense of fashion.
I think that depends on what you're...
No, that wasn't a question.
When Ms. Wintour, widely believed to be portrayed by Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada, canceled Cyrus's appearance on the cover of Vogue, she canceled some of Cyrus's future earnings potential, according to style expert George Brescia.
Product endorsements, perhaps even her own clothing line.
A magazine cover and the photo shoot inside, in Vogue especially, can bring a whole new light and a whole new audience to a rising star.
So it's all of a sudden, oh my God, I didn't know she could look like that. She looks amazing. And then they open it up and they're like, oh, look at these different looks on her. And so all different kinds of people are seeing her.
But for the magazines, covers are critical for newsstand sales and ad revenue. Jerry Gutman is president of Lexicon Group, a publishing consulting firm. He says magazine editors will look at years' worth of covers and compare them with newsstand sales to figure out just what draws readers in.
It could be that for some reason, the color red or the color blue or the color green or the logo.
Even magazines like Vogue, which rely much more heavily on subscriptions, need newsstand sales to get new subscribers and for drawing in advertisers. But Gutman says in Vogue's case, it probably didn't have to do with sales.
Between Yumi and the lamppost, they have had other covers of a sexual orientation.
So this is really about Anna Wintour not liking Miley Cyrus.
Yeah.
Ouch. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Thank you. cover a decent amount of Hollywood around here, usually about its successes, big box office numbers, new releases, that kind of thing. Now, a moment for the non-successes. Bob Odenkirk and David Cross, whom you might know from their roles in Breaking Bad and Arrested Development, have a new book out. It's called Hollywood Said No, about their scripts that didn't work out quite so well. Guys, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks.
Looking forward to taking a look at the numbers.
Yeah.
I will pass right by that and start by pointing out, gentlemen, that this is a book, this little volume you've put together, of your failures. Is that the best way to, you know, sell a project, Bob?
I don't think, yeah, a movie that doesn't get made, it's not a box office winner, I don't think.
But technically, nor is it a box office loser.
That's true.
So it's
in limbo land.
There. Yeah.
Yeah. It is, though. It's kind of a public record of our failures that we're proudly putting out there.
You know, and I also, not to be overly sensitive, but I wouldn't refer to it as failures. I mean, I think the scripts stand up. And we, both Bob and I, are hypersensitive to being perceived as trying to rip people off. And we're not trying to do that. We think that there's value to this.
I'm sorry. I'm looking book. For the sticker price on this book. $17. Yeah, no, okay. That's fine. Yeah, I can do $17.
It's got a lot of value there. We got some illustrations.
It's $17 worth of stuff?
I'd say it's worth exactly $17.
How do you know, though? And here's the flip side of the question. How do you know, Bob, when you have a hit script as opposed to something that's just you're just writing for fun?
Well, these were written for fun. We definitely wrote these in the same way we wrote Mr. Show, which was, let's make ourselves laugh. At the time, you know, the marketplace was limited, to use the word marketplace.
Marketplace, there, we appreciate that. Thank you. Branding is everything.
But, you know, there weren't nearly as many cable channels, whereas nowadays I think our audience would qualify as a large enough audience for someone to want to make a TV show and even potentially a movie on a low budget scale.
Is comedy necessarily a tougher business to be in entertainment because it's so subjective?
I don't know. I think that there's challenges on all fronts, and I don't think there's more in comedy. In fact, there's such a wide marketplace for comedy. There it is again.
Man, you're awesome.
There is actually a lot of venues for it. I just think when it comes to the big screen and anything that's got satire in it, that's where they aren't sure the audience really wants to see that, and they're always looking for their four-quadrant movie. And
I don't even know what that means.
Be that.
David, give me the tentpole. Give me the four quadrants.
March of the Penguins.
What does that mean?
Four quadrants. You have your 80-year-old Samoan women. That's one quadrant.
Uh-huh.
You have your 2-year-old babies with progeria. That's quadrant two.
I don't even know what
this is all
either.
Known. This is all known by the studios. Your third quadrant is a guy named Jesus, and he lives in Bakersfield, I believe. Your fourth quadrant is Inuits.
I don't even know where to go. We could
try
stop
to get
now,
a movie that gets all those people, and that's why we've written this movie.
Difficult.
This movie has a scene for each of those quadrants.
At once.
I think
that, you know, at the core of what you're saying is, how frustrated are we with the system of trying to get movies
made?
That
is what I'm saying.
I don't know. Maybe it's just because we're older and we've gotten, you know, rope-a-doped too much in the head, but it just can't make you mad. It is what it is. And there are ways in which things are more open now. I mean, Netflix, Arrested Development coming back after all that time. I mean, that's something that would never and could never have happened, I don't think.
Yeah.
But when you want to mount something that costs as much as a feature and costs as much to promote as a feature, then I guess that becomes different.
And you're talking about two very distinct worlds with different business plans when you talk about studio films and anything else. Bob said something that it was really perfect, and it's the only smart thing he's ever said, and it was that if you went to somebody and said, hey, we have a movie, and I think if you put the money into making it pre-production, production, post-production, marketing, you could make $1 million profit net. And they were like, this is a fact. This is proven. You will make $1 million. Yeah. And they just don't care. They don't want to make $1 million. They want to make 40, 50, 60, 100, $200 million. And back when we were kind of writing the scripts, there was much less opportunity to fund a project where somebody would be happy, delighted to make $1 million. And now there's a lot more of those. And so the world has kind of opened up and changed quite a bit.
The book by Bob Odenkirk and David Cross with their buddy Brian Posehn is called Hollywood Said No. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I did, for the record, ask both of them what's coming up on their more well-known projects, and you can hear what they said about a Breaking Bad spinoff for Bob Odenkirk and another season of Arrested Development for David Cross at Marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which 10.2 million people are revealed as having been duped. Maybe you too saw the video of a young woman who, we are led to believe, catches fire while doing that Miley Cyrus dance from a couple of weeks ago. Here, I am sorry to have to tell you, is the truth.
And even though the video is fake, that did not stop hundreds of news outlets from showing it. Some people even blamed Miley Cyrus as if this was her fault.
Jimmy Kimmel on his show last night admitting he faked the whole thing. 10.2 million people, might I say again, have seen that on YouTube. He did add, by the way, at the end, quote, "Thank you for helping us deceive the world and hopefully putting an end to twerking forever. Amen, my brother." All right. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Lana Anwar, Meg Kramer, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The interim producer of the Marketplace Morning Report is Sean Bowditch. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.